Good morning. My name is Sarah Hudnall. I am connected here at Calvary through a life group and by serving in the nursery. Today's reading is from John 6, verses 22 through 35. On the next day, the crowd that remained on the other side of the sea saw that there had been only one boat there, and that Jesus had not entered the boat with his disciples, but that his disciples had gone away alone. Other boats from Tiberias came near the place where they had eaten the bread after the Lord had given thanks. So when the crowd saw that Jesus was not there, nor his disciples, they themselves got into the boats and went to Capernaum seeking Jesus. When they found him on the other side of the sea, they said to him, "Rabbi, when did you come here?" Jesus answered them, "Truly, truly, I say to you, you are seeking me not because you saw signs, but because you ate your fill of the loaves. Do not work for the food that perishes, but for the food that endures to eternal life, which the Son of Man will give to you. For on him God the Father has set his seal." Then they said to him, "What must we do to be doing the works of God?" Jesus answered them, "This is the work of God, that you believe in him whom he has sent." So they said to him, "Then what sign do you do that we may see and believe you? What work do you perform?" "Our fathers ate the manna in the wilderness, as it is written, 'He gave them bread from heaven to eat.'" Jesus then said to them, "Truly, truly, I say to you, it was not Moses who gave you the bread from heaven, but my Father gives you the true bread from heaven. For the bread of God is he who comes down from heaven and gives life to the world." They said to him, "Sir, give us the bread always." Jesus said to them, "I am the bread of life. Whoever comes to me shall not hunger, and whoever believes in me shall not thirst."
Sarah. Well, we are picking up the story from where we left off last week, and it continues very much so the same idea. And I don't just mean that because last week we were in the first little bit of chapter 6, and now we're in the last two-thirds of it. I'm not just talking about how we're in the same chapter. But while it is helpful, we have these chapters and these headings that John did not have when he wrote this book, but they're really helpful in this book in particular because John seems to contain an entire idea within a chapter. So John chapter 6 is all about one singular thing. And so that means that we can pick, we can use the work that we did last week to understand what's going on this week. We get that because, as was just read for us, the narrative just flows right into it. It says the next day, and we get into the story that's happening. So right after Jesus feeds the 5,000 men and all those others there, they wake up the next day and they see Jesus is gone, and they're trying to track him down. Even all the language is about bread throughout this. It is one singular idea that's flowing through it. We just wanted to split it over a couple weeks because, you know, there's, what is it, 71 verses in this chapter? And I didn't feel capable of doing that all in one week. But all the background work that we did last week works for this week as well. The context is it's taking place on the Passover, this feast of the Jews, that they would remember God's work to rescue and deliver his people. That this is taking place in this testing that just occurred for the disciples. They were tested to see would they put their faith in Jesus in this remote area. Sounds quite a bit like the Israelites were tested after the Passover. And then you have this crowd who's there, who's following Jesus, but they do not seem to fully understand who he is. And that idea gets picked on right away. All throughout this, we're focused in on this crowd who's following Jesus, but they miss it over and over again. Last week in John chapter 6, verse 15, they see that Jesus is this man who does incredible signs, and then right in front of their eyes, he multiplies food in front of them just from five loaves and two fish that all of these people were able to eat freely and be filled. And it says as a result of that, that they try to seize him by force and make him to be king. They see the power that he has, which is good. But whether or not this is what Jesus has come for, they want to cause him to be this king over them that would kick out the Roman invaders and allow them to live in the way they thought they ought to be living in. We continue in the story here after they wake up and see Jesus is gone. They finally find him and they follow him in John chapter 26. And Jesus says, "You're not following me because you like the signs, the show that I put on. You're just hungry again. You ate yesterday and now that food's gone. You woke up this morning and you're hungry again. And that's why you're following after me." They see that Jesus was able to meet one of their tangible needs, which is true and right. Jesus has compassion on his people. But if all they see Jesus as is a button that they can push and get what they feel they need, well, they're not understanding Jesus. Or in verse 28, after Jesus is talking to them and he explains about this work of God that is happening through him, they start to get excited. They start to fantasize. Ooh, what skills are we going to get? What fun tricks can we do? Jesus just multiplied food. How cool would it be to do that? All right, Jesus, give me these powers. Give me these abilities. What do we need to do in order to act like you do? And Jesus is saying, that's not the point of it. It's following me. It's believing in me. That's the work that you're here to do. Or finally, in verse 30, after continuing this idea, they say, well, you're saying to believe in you, that you're the object of our faith. Can you prove it? What sign can you show to show that you're right in this? What can you do to demonstrate that you're worthy of putting our faith into? They even reference Moses. Moses had these abilities. That's how people knew to follow him. Trying to manipulate, twist the Bible to say what it is that they want it to say. Imagine people trying to do that. Force the Bible to say what they want it to say. Thank goodness we don't live in a world like that. So essentially, all throughout this teaching from Jesus, he's showing them, believe in me. I'm the object of your faith. Find what you are looking for in me. And time after time after time, the crowd just keeps going, well, what else you got? What else can you do for us? What else can you show? Jesus is confronting the desires that this crowd, I mean, think about the categories that he is working through, these things that this crowd wants. They want their circumstance to change. That's why they want to have a king. They want tangible needs to be met. They want signs, proof that they're believing in the right area. They want some power and ability and authority. They want all of these different things in this passage. And all along the while, Jesus is not saying that you're wrong for wanting these things. He's not saying that your desires are off. He's not saying that you shouldn't be wanting these things. He's saying that these desires are good, but we often find lesser satisfaction, things that are less than what we truly need. And Jesus is saying, what you need is me. Find what you desire in me. But what's really scary, what's really spooky about the desires that we have is that we can be so narrowly focused on what we think it is that our desires are for, that our vision can just zoom in on one particular thing, and that's the thing. I need this thing, and miss out on the bigger picture of what it is that we truly need. We get so closed in our focus as to thinking one particular thing is what our desires are for, but miss the bigger picture of what it is that we truly need. Let me give an example of this. We see it pretty clearly with food. Food is such a good gift that we need it for the nourishment of our bodies, and yet the things that we most often desire, that we have cravings for, they're the things that are typically falling into the category of salt or fat or sweet. And those are good things. Those make meals delicious. But when we eat out of proportion from those categories, that's what makes our body get out of proportion. Our desires that we have are not often in what is actually what's best and what's good for us. When we're having conversations with people, they might say, yeah, I've just been really jonesing for some ice cream lately. We don't often retort back like, yeah, dude, I get it. I've been on this huge broccoli kick lately. Or like, last night was wild. I polished off a whole pizza. It's like, dude, I'm right there with you. I ate twice the recommended serving size of lentils. Like, we don't often have these cravings. Our desires are not directed towards the things that our body actually needs. But our desires narrow our focus so much to think this has got to be it. It's got to be this thing. When it's not truly what's good for us. The desires that we feel the strongest for are rarely directed to what we truly need. It doesn't mean those desires are bad. We're just bad at finding out what we're being pulled towards. I mean, think about how we're designed to be with people. We were never meant to be alone. We need community. We need each other. But how easy is it to fill that desire that we have with people who aren't good for us? Or the fact that we come home after a long day of work and we're tired, we're just exhausted, and the things that we feel the pull towards, the things that we fill our time with, don't necessarily make us less tired. They don't energize us. They just sort of pass the time until the next day and we repeat it again. Or think about how much of life has been set up in a way that we can do things quickly and efficiently, that so much is instant around us, so much is making things easier than ever for us to accomplish more and more and more. And it builds this desire in us of, well, everything's got to be easy. Everything's got to be fast. And yet the fast solutions are rarely the best solutions. What is the easiest route is rarely the route that we need to take. Now, I say rarely, because what we see in this passage is as Jesus is talking to this crowd who has all of these different desires, desires very much so like you and I have, for circumstances to change, for abilities, for tangible needs to be met, these desires that you and I have. In talking to this crowd, Jesus is not just saying that I am the one who fulfills those desires. I am the one that you are truly looking for. Not the things that I can do for you, not what you might get out of this exchange, but me and me alone. I am the object of your desires. He's not just saying that. He's also saying that when you find that satisfaction in me, you're finding the easiest possible solution that there is. The easiest possible answer to your desires. To be a Christian is the easiest thing in the world to do. This passage is all about the ease of Christianity. Pick it up in John chapter 6, verse 35. Jesus said to them, "I am the bread of life. Whoever comes to me shall not hunger, and whoever believes in me shall never thirst. But I said to you that you have seen me and yet do not believe. All that the Father gives to me will come to me, and whoever comes to me, I will never cast out. For I have come down from heaven not to do my own will, but the will of him who sent me. And this is the will of him who sent me, that I should lose nothing of all that he has given me, but raise it up on the last day. This is the will of my Father." You ever wonder, like, what does God want? "That everyone who looks on the Son and believes in him should have eternal life, and I will raise him up on the last day." Jesus has this crowd around him wanting all of these different things, come to Jesus because they think in him they could find what it is that they're looking for, and that's right. But they're missing it. They're so narrow focused as, all right, Jesus is the one who can kick out Rome. That's not what you need right now. You need the Jesus himself. Jesus is the one who can meet tangible needs. That's not what you need right now. You need Jesus himself. Jesus is the one who could possibly give me ability to do cool things. That's not what you need right now. You need Jesus himself. And what he's saying is what you are looking for is actually so much more complex and so much more difficult than what you truly do need. And that's just me. I am the bread of life, Jesus says. I am the one who truly satisfies. Now I know that we saw this back in chapter 4 when Jesus was talking to the woman at the well, that Jesus is the one who satisfies the desires that we have in this life. But what's unique here, what I think the particular bent that Jesus is driving towards in this chapter is showing us how easy it is to find that satisfaction. It's just by believing in him. There's nothing else that we need to do, nothing else that we need to produce, nothing that we need to earn it, that this is something freely given to those who trust in this Jesus, freely given to those who believe in him. If you believe in Jesus, your desires are satisfied. If you believe in him, he will never send you away. If he has come into this world for you, so that all who believe will have eternal life. There is nothing easier than that. Jesus has come to this world as the one that we are all looking for. We don't even have to try to find him. He has come. Jesus is that one who satisfies, and it's the easiest thing in the world to believe in him. I think of the Apostle Paul in talking about what salvation looks like, what the work of God looks like. He captures this well as well in Ephesians 2, verses 8 and 9. He says, "For it's by grace you have been saved through faith. And this is not of your own doing. It's the gift of God, not a result of works, so that no one may boast." See, it's a gift. It's grace. It's God doing all of this. It's not what anyone has ever done save for the work of Jesus himself. That's the entire basis of it. It could not be easier. This crowd goes to Jesus and they are excited about what they might get out of the exchange, and yet what they are wanting is not only more difficult, but it's also not what they truly need. They're missing it on both parts. They come with excitement of, this one has power and authority. We've never seen anyone like it. Maybe he can be the one who can rescue us in this way. But Jesus is saying, I've come to rescue you in a way that you need even more so. Jesus has these abilities to meet their tangible needs and say, all right, when's the next meal coming in? But they're missing the fact that Jesus is coming to meet all of the needs that they have. They see Jesus has authority and power and abilities. And they like those things, but they miss the fact that he is the one who has power and ability and authority. They're looking for proofs. How do we know that this is real? Missing the fact that Jesus right in front of them is showing them that this is possible because he has come. Showing that it's possible because of the sure and completed works that he will do. All along it, they come with these expectations and desires, but they're so narrowed in on it, they miss the bigger piece of Jesus himself is the one who does it. He is the bread of life. It's the easiest thing in the world to receive him. Easier than the answers that they're trying to find. Don't settle for what is lesser. Don't settle for what does not satisfy. Find all that you desire in this Jesus. And there's nothing that you and I have to do. Like Ephesians 2 says, it's not by works. There's nothing that we need to produce for it. There's nothing that we need to do to make ourselves worthy of it. There's nothing that we need to do to show Jesus, like, I'm worthy of being on your team. Jesus is the bread of life. You don't have to bake it. Jesus is the bread of life. You don't have to go and try to find him. He has done it all. Believe in me. Receive of me. And all of those desires are satisfied. This passage is about the ease of the Christian life. It's the easiest thing in the world to do. This passage is about the difficulty of the Christian life. That even though there's nothing more easy than believing in Jesus, some of us, all of us, still have other desires that we aim for, have other answers that we're trying to find. We talk about the desires of this crowd and over again, we're saying these are good things to want, but they're trying to find it in wrong places. They're settling for what is more complex, more difficult, and less satisfying. And there's plenty of times that we are like this crowd, and we might say, that's nice and all, but what else you got? And it's in that context of this crowd still not believing in him that we get the longest section of uninterrupted teaching from Jesus in this chapter that also happens to be the grossest. John 6, verse 52, or 53. So Jesus said to them, truly, truly, I say to you, unless you eat the flesh of the Son of Man and drink his blood, you will not have life in you. Whoever feeds on my flesh and drinks of my blood has eternal life, and I will raise him up on the last day. For my flesh is true food, and my blood is true drink. Whoever feeds on my flesh and drinks my blood abides in me and I in him. As the living Father sent me, and I live because of the Father, so whoever feeds on me, he also will live because of me. This is the bread that came down from heaven. Not like the bread your fathers ate and died. Whoever feeds on this bread will live forever. So Jesus comes and says, if you eat of my flesh and drink of my blood, that is how you are satisfied. That is how your desires are met. And it's kind of gross to read that. I would just quickly point out that we often use language of eating, that eating is so important that we often use it as imagery to talk about things that we're immersed in, that we're satisfied by, that we are fully engaged in. Maybe we didn't acknowledge that. We might be distracted at the time thinking of a series that we've just been devouring recently, just been watching it constantly. Or maybe we appreciated the words that Jesus said. We just ate them all up, and it just left us feeling full afterwards. We often use the language of eating to talk about our immersion in something that we're fully engaged with, and that's what Jesus is talking about here. But to completely dispel it all, this is figurative. Jesus is not saying that you need to track down his body and eat him in any sort of way. And we know that for a couple of reasons. One, the Old Testament has very strong rules against mixing flesh and blood together. And so Jesus is not going to contradict that. We could also point out it's not very keen on cannibalism either. It also, like, Jesus never physically told his disciples to do it. He's not missing patches of himself just because he keeps feeding his disciples with himself. But you also have, it's really fascinating that this was the case, one of the first complaints about the early Christians in the first century, they were accused of being cannibals because they would have a meal called the Lord's Supper where they said they would eat of the flesh and drink of the blood of their Savior. And they were quick to rush and say, no, it's symbolism. It's symbolism. We're just remembering that Jesus is the one who satisfies our needs. We're remembering that we are consumed and nourished by him. We are remembering that the completed work of Jesus is our basis for saying that we have life. From the very beginning, it's been going back to this idea that Jesus talks about and says, we are fully immersed in what he's doing. We are fully satisfied in him. That by joining our lives to him, that is how we find our desires met. But in doing this so, in speaking with this really forceful language in this section, Jesus is accomplishing two things. One, he's trying to show us we have a desire that's filled by him alone. He is the only source of nourishment. He is the only satisfaction that we can find for the desires that's in every single one of us. But the second reason why he uses this forceful language is he knows there's people in the crowd around him who's not going to do that. They're not going to believe. That they're along for the ride. They like some of the things Jesus is doing. They like some of the messaging. They like some of the signs. The meal was great. They have reasons to be around Jesus, but this idea of finding him as their source of satisfaction, finding him as the object of their desires, well, they're not going to do that. And so the very first bump in the road, the very first obstacle in the way, well, they're going to use that as an off-ramp. They're going to use that as a reason to bail. And we see that as we get to John 6:6:6. Ooh, scary. It says, after this, many of his disciples turned back and no longer walked with him. Well, it is scary. It's a hard thing to read. Jesus has this crowd around him who are not listening to what they truly need. And Jesus speaks in a way that gets to the heart of the matter, that reveals what's going on in these people's lives. That while they're around him, while they're along for the ride, they're unwilling to put their trust in him. They're unwilling to believe. And so he uses this language to help reveal what's going on in their hearts. He uses this teaching to show what it is that they need and what it is that they're unwilling to do. And that's something, that mentality of this crowd is something that continues to this day. All throughout this passage, this crowd is saying, so what else do you have? What else you got? Where are we wanting more? Following Jesus is the easiest thing in the world. He is the one we so desperately need. But where might we be still saying, what else do you got? Maybe like the crowd, we're holding out for proofs. Like if only God would show that this is truly the right way. Like if he would just write it in the sky, like, I am God, believe in Jesus. If he would do that so everyone could see, then that would prove it. That would demonstrate that this is real. Or if you would just address these intellectual arguments against Christianity, if you would clear the way of those, then I could believe. And yet just like what we find with this crowd, the first bump is the excuse that's given to bail. You could go to all the historical record, give all the reasons in the world why God exists, and yet still not come into faith. They hit a bump and they bail. Or thinking of the places where Christianity could sound offensive to modern mentalities, if we could just get rid of those, if we could remove those teachings, if we could get rid of some of those hard things to say, if we would just stop going on and on about how Jesus is the one way to salvation, that would make it so much easier for other people to believe. If we could just clear those away, then people would come. And yet the churches that have tried to get rid of some of the offense of the gospel have been in drastic decline, more so than any other group. If we would just ask less of people. I mean, yeah, we say following Jesus is the easiest thing in the world, but this belief in him comes with a transformed life, a transformed desires, transformed interest. That if we would just say, you know, you're not doing anything wrong. You don't need to change anything about your life. Just tack Jesus onto it, keep doing what you're doing, and you'll be fine. The hard part is that's not who Jesus truly is. So if we're giving that Jesus to people, then that's not a Jesus who can satisfy their desires. Or for others, the ease of Christianity just, well, it doesn't sound like it's enough. Like, how am I truly going to know? How do I know that I'm saved? How do I know that I'm fine with God? If I can get a list of prerequisites for entering into heaven and spend my life checking off those boxes, then at the end of my life, I could say, yep, I've done it all. I'm good to go. But this way of just finding our satisfaction in him, of him being the one who does all the work, well, I don't know for certain. That doesn't feel like it's good enough. I need something to do. I need something to wrap my hands around to show I have done it. It's the ease itself that becomes difficult to understand. Or even just the hardship of life. When things go bad and when we look around the world around us, when we see how easy it is to follow Jesus and yet go through difficulty, and in those moments that we are by ourselves just screaming out, God, why is everything just so hard? Following you is supposed to be the easiest thing in the world, so why are things so difficult? Are you truly worth sticking with? What more are you looking for? I am in need of proof. I am removing obstacles. I am unwilling to change how I live. I'm struggling to see that you are enough. So many places in life we find rival I am statements. But it's only here that we find the statement that truly lasts, that truly helps, that truly gives guidance, that truly satisfies our needs. And it's when Jesus says, I am the bread of life. It's him. It's only him. He is the one who has accomplished our saving. He is the only one source of satisfaction. But what I so appreciate, though, as someone who is constantly crying out for more, is that that's not where the passage ends. We have this moment that is terrifying to think of all, this crowd that's gathered around Jesus, and they're missing it. They're missing it so badly. And they leave in this time, and there it comes with questions of, well, would I be part of that crowd? I mean, I don't understand Jesus perfectly. I'm crying out for more. My faith wavers. I feel tested at times, and I don't feel like I'm doing enough. How do I know I'm not part of the crowd that leaves in John chapter 6, verse 66? Because that's not where it ends. Jesus is speaking to this crowd, and they only want what they get out of the exchange. They don't want Jesus himself. We mentioned how this passage starts with the testing of the disciples, much like the testing of the Israelites after the Passover. And they were being saved by God, rescued by him, and they bickered every step of the way. God miraculously provided them food, they bickered. God gave them water, they bickered. God was leading them to a promised land they did not deserve as their home, and they bickered. Their faith was tested, and it crumbled. We had the disciples earlier when Jesus says, I'm going to feed this crowd. And they said, where's this going to come from? They had an opportunity to put their faith in Jesus, to trust in him, and their faith wavered. We have this crowd here who turns away from God. We're even told that one of the disciples will betray Jesus in the most horrifying way. It sure seems like, man, just people do not do enough. Their faith's not strong enough. We're all going to waver. But it's in the midst of what just sounds so difficult that there's just no hope. Who can be good enough for this? That we're reminded of the one who is good enough for this. John 6, 67. So Jesus said to the 12, do you want to go away as well? And Simon Peter answered him, Lord, To whom shall we go? You have the words of eternal life. We have believed and come to know that you are the Holy One of God. As people are turning away, as faith is failing, as people are crying out for more and more and more, Peter just says simply, like, where else would we go but you? It's only in you that we find satisfaction. You are the object of our desires. And what I so greatly appreciate about this is Peter will go from this event and mess up continually. That he will constantly fail. He will blunder. He will make mistakes. He will try to pull Jesus aside and correct him, saying, no, no, Jesus, you don't understand Jesus well enough. He will constantly not do what Jesus has come to do. And it's not just before he is saved. It's not just before the Spirit comes. There's like the whole written account of the life of Peter is him making mistakes. He has to be pulled aside, even as he is the rock on which the church is being built. Paul has to correct him. He has to be rebuked. He has to be told, no, no, you're giving in to the pressures of the crowd around you. You're not doing what Jesus is actually calling you to. All throughout his life, Peter makes mistake after mistake after mistake. His faith is tested repeatedly, and it wavers repeatedly. He too has desires. He too is full of confusion. He too is pulled in multiple directions like you and I are. He is part of the disciples who will continue to make blunders. He has Jesus right in front of him, and he doesn't understand Jesus, and yet he knows enough to say, though, and this is what differentiates the crowd from Peter in this time. He knows enough to say, I don't know, but it's you. I don't know these other things, but it's you. I don't trust enough, but it's you. Even though Peter will make so many mistakes, he has enough to say, Jesus, you are the source, and that is exactly right. This statement is so wonderful and so beautiful. While all of these people are turned away, we're told about Judas and how he will turn away. Their faith has been tested and they have failed time and time again throughout the story that God writes for his people are faithful, but then not. Faithful and then not. So what hope is there? What could we possibly say is what enables us to find the satisfaction of our desires? Well, it's enough to say, I can't do it. It's you. He sees the simplicity of what it is to follow Jesus. And though he does not follow Jesus perfectly, he follows sufficiently because it's built on the one who could truly satisfy. And that's what makes it easy. Our life will be full of ups and downs. We will have times that we feel right there in lockstep with Jesus and other times where it's like, where'd you go? We have times when we're feeling so alive in our quiet time and other times when, do I really have to keep doing this? We'll have so many ups and downs in this times, but what makes this easy? What makes this steady? What makes Jesus the object of our desire is that no matter what's going on around there, no matter our ability to understand perfectly right or not, more often than not, is in the fact that we can go, I don't know Jesus, but it's you. Where else would I go but find it in you? And that is enough.